Welcome to the Welsh Agenda podcast from the Institute of Welsh Affairs. I'm Andy Regan, Policy and External Affairs Manager at the IWA, and this is our 2019 general election debrief. It's the morning after the night before, Friday the 13th of December, unlucky for some, and on this occasion it was Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party and Jo Swinson's Liberal Democrats. We're joined by three friends of the IWA. We have Jess Blair, who's the Director of the Electoral Reform Society Cymru. We're also joined by Mia Rees, a self-declared youth policy nerd. I'm disappointed to hear that that's not her actual job title. Mia's also recently elected as a Conservative councillor to represent Whitchurch and Tongwyn Lice in the north of Cardiff. We also have Oliver Townsend, who's Policy and External Affairs Manager for Cymarth Cymru, the representative body for homelessness and support organisations, and he's a lay member and extremely occasional campaigner for the Welsh Liberal Democrats. Thanks for coming in, everybody.
Thank you.
How did you all spend last night? What time were you up till, Jess?
I don't think there's been a difference between today and yesterday, to be honest. I don't know what sleep is anymore. I don't know what my name is, so this is going to be interesting.
Okay, well, we'll muddle through.
Yep.
Mio, how did you spend it?
On the sofa. Started with Sky coverage and then managed to convince my husband to move to the BBC coverage for the exit poll. And then stuck it through to 7:30 this morning. With a couple of Coronas and a few cups of tea.
Okay. Oliver, how?
Lasted till about 4:30, and then I gave up in despair.
I say I was out at an election gathering, and I think I'm now in favour of having spoiler-free election coverage. I think the exit polls actually ruin the experience of watching it. I think it should be like football matches where they give you a chance to look away if you don't want to know the result and then watch it as it plays out in real time, otherwise it's just not the same. So, we're here to talk a little bit about the campaign and reflect on the results. We're not going to have a political debate because I think probably everybody's had enough of that. And then we'll have a bit more of a discussion about what this might mean for Wales over the next few years. But I wanted to come to you first, Jess, just to hear from the ERS's perspective. Like, what sort of election has this been? How well have people's votes been? How much have people's votes mattered in this campaign?
So what we've seen in last night's election results is actually, obviously, the Conservatives having massive gains. They've gained 47 seats at present time. Obviously, we're waiting for one declaration still. But that's 47. Labour are down 59. And actually, when you actually dig down into details, there's only 1.2% increase in the Conservatives' vote share on 2017. You know, Boris Johnson hasn't, in effect, done that much better than Theresa May. He's just benefited from an electoral system and a really, really bad night for Labour.
And what are we seeing in terms of like how numbers of votes per seat that people are getting?
So in Wales, 52.2% of voters are unrepresented. That means they didn't vote for their MP. And we're seeing massive disparity in, you know, the numbers that you actually need to elect an MP in different parties. So, for example, it took 864,000 votes to elect one Green MP versus 25,882 votes for an SNP MP. So you can see the disparity there. You know, not everyone's votes are equal, and that's something that's fundamentally wrong.
And do you think there's going to be much appetite for that to change in light of the result?
Well, I think now we're in a situation where there's a strong Conservative majority and the Conservative Party are not likely to want to reform. What we do have the opportunity, I think, is to campaign around things on a much more local level, hopefully kind of votes at 16, deliberative democracy across England. In Wales, I think we need to focus on the Assembly elections, Assembly reform, local government reform here. And we also need to make sure that the Labour Party at UK level really takes the fact that they haven't won an election without Tony Blair in the last 50 years seriously. If Labour don't get behind electoral reform now, then what are they doing?
So I just wanted to reflect on the campaign itself. We all know the result. Whether it was a surprise or not in the end is unclear. But what, at a kind of micro level or a constituency level, what have been the surprises from the campaign for you, Mia?
To be honest, I think although the Conservatives were really hopeful in North Wales, I think there was a sense on the ground that, well, we've worked really hard and we've given it a really good shot, but let's not get our hopes up too much. And I think there was actually a really ecstatic air in the rooms in those North Walian seats, because I think there was an element of surprise. And even in Brecon and Radnor, I was speaking to people who were on the campaign trail with Faye Jones, going, well, it's ever so close, she won it with a 7,000 majority. It really wasn't that close in the end. So whether there were shy Tories that weren't saying that they were going to vote Tory on the door, maybe the party wasn't hitting the right areas, so actually weren't getting a reflection of exactly what they thought. And I think that's been a pleasant surprise, one that we're hopeful for. Whilst a lot of the commentary was on whether the Conservatives would lose the Vale and gain Gower, and that, of course, didn't happen. So that's another slight surprise, I think, from my perspective.
Oliver, I'm not going to necessarily ask you if you've had been pleasant surprises. It's not been a great election for the Lib Dems. Your leader, UK level, has lost her seat, and your leader in Wales has lost her seat. But has there been anything from your point of view that has gone well for the Lib Dems in this election, if anything?
So at UK level, the Lib Dems have gained 1 million votes. And I'm not saying that as a politician who's trying to spin it as a good result. It's an absolute disaster. I think, you know, nobody will be under any surprise that I agree with the Electoral Reform Society. I think the idea that you can gain over 1 million votes at a UK level and lose seats, I think there's something fundamentally wrong there. But people would expect me to say that as a Liberal Democrat. I think I was pleasantly surprised, I think, and very much looking for the sort of silver lining shrapnel behind the sofa. The Lib Dems kept a lot more deposits in the Welsh elections this year than they have done in previous elections since the coalition. And depending what happens with the Brexit Party, I think that could lead the way to more, a return of representation in the Welsh Assembly in 2021. And I think the regional election will be one to watch, because when you look at the sort of 5-6% kind of average across regions, that can result in different circumstances in more regional list members. So it's an awful night. I'm absolutely gutted for, you know, Jane Dodds, who worked really hard in Brecon and Radnor. I'm sure Faye will be a brilliant MP as well. But I think there is long-term hope. I think what it does raise is real questions about the electoral system, but also, I suppose, some questions on Liberal Democrat strategy as well.
I mean, thinking about the strategy, some of the seats in Wales were Unite to Remain seats, and there was fair bit of criticism, fair to say, that around specific seats there, for example, Cardiff Central, uniting to Remain against Joe Stevens, who's a very strongly pro-Remain MP. How could that have ever worked better? Was there ever the possibility of working more closely with Labour in that alliance, or was that never going to happen?
That's a massive question, which I'll try and answer really quickly. I think traditionally Labour doesn't do alliances. They were approached, from what I've read. Again, I'm not very heavily involved in the party, so I don't know the exact details of what talks there were. But I do know Labour were approached, and I think in some seats, had those really grown-up conversations been had, like they appear to have been had in Northern Ireland, I think you could have seen much more of a Remain alliance actually making an impact at the ballot box. I don't understand the Cardiff Central one, if I'm entirely honest. I think the idea of Unite to Remain against one of the strongest Remain voices in Wales is a bit strange. But yeah, if you look at Northern Ireland, where the Remain vote was allowed to kind of coalesce around particular representatives, that could have been a model for the rest of the UK.
Jess, can you see, given what you've said about the results and parties not getting seats in proportion to their vote share, can you see that as something that other parties might coalesce around in future, having an electoral reform alliance and change the system in a future election? Is that something you're hopeful of?
I think it could go one of two ways, to be honest. And I think there's either going to be a kind of groundswell among the kind of left centrist parties for reform, or, you know, you've already got Nigel Farage talking about rebranding the Brexit Party as the Reform Party and advocating for reform there. And I think that presents a really strategic question, I think, for some of the smaller parties about whether they actually, how they work together and who they work together with around reform, and how the campaign actually changes from here on in.
I was thinking about the campaign more generally. I mean, how good do we feel about this election as a result overall? Mia, could I ask you, obviously this is presumably the result you were hoping for, but how do you feel about the way the Conservatives have won this election?
I'll be honest, I don't think it was the best campaign. I don't think it was the most detailed campaign. I think it was quite a sort of high-level, short messages campaign, and I don't think there was much delving into policy. I also think, just from a personal point of view, there was much more emphasis in the media on scandals and personalities than there was on going in depth into policies and promises. And actually, I think that was a real missed opportunity, and it actually kind of gave my party the carte blanche just to say, we will get Brexit done in answer to every question. They were almost sort of allowed to get away with that, and I don't think that was positive. I only remember seeing a few interviews where they said, well, what does actually getting Brexit done mean? What does it mean for the trade agreements afterwards? And there were some of those discussions this morning, and I thought, why were we not hearing them in the election, if I'm completely honest? Yes, I am really pleased, but I don't think it was the best campaign. I think that Labour did have a very mixed message. It wasn't as short and sharp, and they should have recognised much sooner that they were up against someone with a very clear message, whether they agreed with it or not, that was getting through to people, and people knew what it was. And it wasn't the case for Labour. That, for the many, not the few, that they used last time, that really got through to people. People understood it, they knew what it meant, and they just lack that same momentum, I feel, this time.
Yeah, I mean, there's a tension there, isn't there? Like, we think we're all policy people gathered around the microphone today. We probably would like to see more detailed policy discussion happening in elections generally, but there is a bit of a tension between that and the need to cut through lots of that noise. You've mentioned scandals that were happening. If scandals don't happen, the media doesn't report on them.
I think, to be honest, I think we, as policy professionals and people who are really interested in policy, and also the media, are more interested in scandals than actually the public are. When I go into seats where there's been, inverted commas, scandals, yeah, you do get the odd person on the door, but they're quite few and far between. You know, in a three-hour canvassing session, you could have two, whilst, you know, I would say two-thirds of them want to talk to you about Brexit. And I think that's really interesting. And I think that actually we're doing a disservice to voters in thinking that they care more about gossip than policy, because actually I find when I'm on the doors, they don't.
It's really tricky. I think I totally agree. If it's kind of your normal standard, bog standard scandal, I would totally agree, and I've got very little time for that. I think some of the questions around, particularly Boris Johnson this year, were around the values that drive him in politics.
Yeah.
And that's why I think those questions were really important. And I think that's one of the main reasons he copiously avoided any sort of legitimate and detailed scrutiny in the campaign. In any way where he couldn't get away with saying get Brexit done. I think there's, in general, the campaign has been one of the most negative, difficult and actually quite scary campaigns that I've been involved in. I've been campaigning since I was 15. So for about 16 years, it's certainly the worst one I've seen. An 89-year-old member of our party was campaigning in Newport and was followed around an estate, and someone said to him that if he was any younger, he'd have him on the floor beating him up. We've seen people physically attacked in the campaign, and myself and my partner, you know, we've campaigned more in this election than we have for a long time. It sounds exaggerated, but as two gay men, we were scared to go out campaigning for Remain. And I honestly don't think that this campaign is going to be the last of that, because the party in question, the one that's won, has actually gained an electoral reward from that atmosphere and an electoral reward from the way in which the campaign's been conducted. So I think if we want to stop that from happening again, I think we need to have really serious conversations about the future of our politics.
I mean, I'm really interested in how we can drive that as people kind of operating within civil society, but isn't one of the really unfortunate things we've learned from this election is that the public don't care how people are conducting themselves? It's been very clear that there's been a lot of lies and aggressive and bullying behaviour, and it doesn't seem to have hurt anybody who's behaved in that way electorally.
I think that there's almost like a tension in the discourse around politics at the moment, and I think it's a question about what really cuts through to the public. So I think Labour have been seriously damaged by discussions around anti-Semitism, whereas Boris Johnson hasn't been as damaged by discussions around his values or lack of scrutiny or the kind of, how do I put this, testing the measures of campaign regulations in this election, you know, the kind of ads that they've been using. I think one's really gone down much worse for the public than the other, and I think that there's a question for the Labour Party there, and why? Is that because of Jeremy Corbyn? You know, are voters looking for an excuse not to vote for him and to vote for Boris Johnson? And I think there's also a question in the media of how they are covering elections and reporting on this kind of issue.
I think there's also the fact that the anti-Semitism has been a growing issue that's built over a long period of time, and therefore it gives it a longer period of time to get into people's consciousness and to people to develop strong feelings about it. Was actually in a relatively short election period, which is what this was, there's less time for that kind of build and consideration and reflection and thinking about how that makes you feel about that individual, and I think that made quite a big difference.
I think that we'll probably come to it if we're discussing constitutional arrangements later, but there are those unwritten rules that have governed British politics for a long time about the kind of, and they're not always followed, obviously, but about the kind of decency of campaigning. And all it takes is for one or two individuals within parties to start not following those rules. And there's some electoral advantage in that. And actually, it shows to me that the real limits of a essentially self-governing political elite, really, where finally they've thrown off the shackles of decency that kept kind of British politics running for decades. And it definitely feels very different to anything I've seen in 15 years.
Yeah. The only thing I would say is when I've been speaking to colleagues who were campaigning in the 70s, they say this is very similar to what they remember from the 70s. Now, that is a long time ago, I completely appreciate that, but these are people with long memories who've been very involved in politics for a long time, and they say, yes, there is an increased nastiness, for want of a better word, but they say that it's very comparable to what they see in the 70s, and they don't view it as worse than that. They just view it as quite different, which I think is interesting.
I mean, we've, in Wales, in our next set of elections, we're going to have people voting at the age of 16. Mm. More young people getting into politics, I think we probably all agree, is a good thing. There'll be some 18-year-olds out there who've voted. This will be their first general election that they've voted in. Mia, what would you say to them if this is their first experience of voting?
Well, I have to say, I think if they look at the stats, no matter which way their party went, their vote really did have the opportunity to matter. Even where there are Conservative majorities, there's not really any that are massive out there. And actually, turnout amongst the younger age group, as we know, is 57% compared to 69% normally across all age groups. And I think, you know, if younger voters turned out in those numbers, there is that real opportunity for them to make that change, and I would have a really positive, I think that's a really positive message to send out, saying to people that this was an election that really could decide the direction of the country, and it has, and young people having a say in that is really important. So I think that actually, although some young people might not be happy with the result, there was a really real opportunity there. And I think it's also really important that we don't think that young people are all one homogenous group, that they all vote the same way and they all think the same thing. They absolutely don't. They have a whole range of opinions, like every age group. And I think that gets lost a lot in the discussions on this.
I think one of the really interesting stats that's going to come out of this election is analysis on youth turnout. And obviously there was this narrative in 2017 that there was a youth quake, and then that was found to actually be not necessarily the case. But Stuart Fox from Brunel University, formerly of Cardiff University, has pointed out that in the 20 seats with the most 18 to 35-year-olds, turnout was down 1.5%, despite voter registrations being up an average of 6%. So it does look like it's likely that young people haven't turned out in as high numbers as they did in 2017.
I mean, let's think about Wales now. So within the campaign itself, within the election, how much has Wales been a factor? Before we knew the results yesterday, did we feel like Wales had a voice in this election? Obviously, some seats have proven to be quite decisive, but were we visible during the campaign?
I think we were, but not to the extent of the other devolved nations, for quite obvious reasons, if I'm honest. I think that there was always a narrative that something big was going to happen with the SNP in Scotland, and that was a bigger story and therefore was reported on. The situation in Northern Ireland continues to be incredibly challenging, and again, that was discussed not actually as much as I thought it should have been. I thought they should have had a lot more coverage than they did in the UK press, if I'm completely honest. I think that because this campaign as well, the NHS has been talked about a lot. It's been a big discussion point. And as we know in this room, the NHS is devolved in Wales. And actually, a lot of voters don't know that, as previous surveys and analysis have showed us. And I think that that's been quite frustrating. I remember reading, getting a copy of the Sunday Times just before the election, and on their front page story was about the NHS, and there was no mention that it was devolved in the other nations. And I think that that has been a real missed opportunity for Wales.
And it's interesting because Richard Wynne-Jones has been speculating on Twitter about this idea of the red wall, which I don't think is a phrase I'd ever heard before.
No, I've never. Has anyone else heard that?
I don't think it's a thing. Let's declare that it's not a thing. But the North East Wales seats, which have largely gone to the Conservatives, he was attributing that basically to the situation around Betsy Cadwaladr Health Board. He was saying that that's a reason for it. There's lots of shaking heads there.
I'm sorry. I agree Betsy Cadwaladr Health Board is an issue in that area, but I don't think it's an issue that is the reason why people in those seats voted Conservative.
In general, no. Sorry, to go back to the initial question and pick up on the Betsy point, and I really hate to disagree with Richard. Generally, no, Wales has not featured in the election. I think there are a couple of debates where Adam Price broke through with a little bit of a bubble on Twitter, but not nationally in any big way, certainly not comparable to Nicola Sturgeon. Mm-hmm. The idea that people in Wales vote on the performance of the health board, it goes against anything that we know about elections in Wales and about the way that the media works in Wales and the way that we consume media in Wales, and we consume English media by and large. And I think that's a massive challenge that will probably take another three podcasts to talk about, is the fact that we consume English media rather than Welsh media. And I think the biggest driver of the in quotes red wall collapse is the fact that I think Darren Hill talked about it on Twitter this morning, is the growth of a north-south divide in Wales. And the only element, I think, where Welsh policy and politics does have an impact is in a growing sense that people in North Wales feel disenfranchised and distanced from the Welsh Government in South Wales. And that's really fascinating when you look at how Labour seats held up in the south of Wales but collapsed in North Wales. So I think Welsh politics does have an impact, but I think it's more from the negative perspective of people's distance from the decision-making powers in Cardiff.
And there's been real questions as well around how Labour's prioritised which seats in Wales it puts resource into and gets feet on the ground in. For example, I think it was actually someone from Plaid Cymru observing that effectively campaigners from Merseyside area were being bussed into campaign in Arfon, driving through those constituencies which have now changed to the Conservatives. So
and Jeremy Corbyn visiting Ceredigion. I think there are huge strategic questions that, you know, as someone who is a left-wing member of the Lib Dems who has occasionally voted Labour, there's serious strategic questions, I think, that the Labour Party in the UK have to answer. And I think the Labour Party in Wales have probably minimised some of their losses in the south, so let's learn what they can learn from what they did well there. But Jeremy Corbyn campaigning in Ceredigion and Arfon, what was that about?
Those two seats in South Wales in particular that they held on, that were projected at one point to potentially be in trouble for Labour, Gower and Cardiff North, they were retained by two very, very effective Labour campaigners, and I would say they bucked the trend rather than kind of continued any kind of pattern we've seen in North Wales. They're the exception, not the rule.
So you think it was the ground game that...
I think ground game comes into it a lot, but I do think that The narrative people were voting on, we talk a lot about Brexit, but also people were voting on, do I see Jeremy Corbyn or do I see Boris Johnson as a Prime Minister? And I've got family members, friends who voted Conservative for the first time just because they couldn't bring themselves to vote Jeremy Corbyn. Even the fact that we've got constituencies, don't get me started on that one. But there is a fundamental question here for Labour about how they campaign and also how they pick their leader and who their next leader might be and whether they can really bring back the kind of centre ground into the Labour Party.
Well, I mean, let's speculate for a moment before we come back to implications for Wales. Who do we think the next leader of the Labour Party might be, and who's going to decide that?
I really couldn't say. I think that you've got to look at where the membership is in the Labour Party, and fundamentally they will elect the next leader of the Labour Party, and where the membership is still on that left wing of the Labour Party, and therefore I think you've honestly, realistically, got to look from a pool of candidates on that side of the party. I mean, we've already had some names sort of bashed around this morning, but I couldn't call an individual. I think there is absolutely a space for someone, for want of a better phrase, the more moderate wing of the Labour Party to stand in that election, to make sure, because when the Labour were sort of under Tony Blair, they always made sure that in the following elections, you know, Jeremy Corbyn was kind of a token candidate initially from that wing. You know, he was sort of rushed onto the ballot to make sure we have someone representing that wing.
It was his turn to be that candidate.
Absolutely, and I think now it's time for the moderates to really make sure they put together a good, solid candidate so there is still someone for those members to vote for.
And as a Conservative, the Labour manifesto, so there's all kinds of criticism of the party and the strategy and Corbyn himself. What there seems to be a consensus around is that they had a good set of policies that they were trying to put out there. Do you think it was the front person who failed to sell those policies, or do you actually think that nobody could sell those policies to the electorate?
I think they sold the wrong policies, if I'm completely honest. In my view, I thought their manifesto was better in the last election. I think leading this time with the big broadband announcement as one of the first ones was the wrong decision. I think if they'd gone for the NHS line from the beginning, their line about privatisation, about deals with the US, I think if they'd started with that and kept that running, I think that could have been more successful.
Labour would say their broadband policy, in terms of kind of an announcement thing, was a massive success. It was the only kind of policy announcement that came up, a push notification on BBC News. It really drove discussion away from Brexit. So they would say it's probably one of the key points of their campaign. What I would say, just going back to the question about the next leader of the Labour Party, we've got a fundamental problem in this country with party politics in that only a very small percentage of the population are actually party members who vote for these people. And party members often aren't representative of the public as a whole, and they often aren't representative of how an actual voter is going to feel about that particular candidate. So there was a massive tension there.
Is there a way to resolve that tension?
Now you're asking me. I think, you know, there are examples across the world of different ways that parties elect their leader, and they're not always great. You know, we've got this kind of presidential system in America, and you know, we've seen the Democratic debates at the moment. They literally just choose leaders for election campaigns. That's no better than this. What I'm saying is that there is a tension, I think, between the fact that party members are often not representative of the whole, and that parties often get kind of tunnel vision, looking just towards their party members, and they really need to be thinking about who's going to go down best with the public, who's going to win the next election.
I think it's a couple of rules of leadership elections, and I always forget, so I'll definitely remember one. But one is that generally you should vote for who you think the other parties don't want to face. Mm-hmm. And the second one is that very rarely actually happens. And so from that question as to who could be the Labour leader, I have no idea. The Labour kind of election leadership internal politics is well beyond my knowledge. Who I think would persuade me maybe to support Labour in an election in a way that, you know, so I lent my vote to the Labour Party in 2017, I couldn't do that this year. So what party leader might convince me to do that again, more enthusiastically? Jess Phillips springs to mind as someone who has got a huge amount of integrity, a lot of the only word that comes to mind is a lot of balls, but you know, a lot of
I think she feels authentic, doesn't
yeah, she is, she's very authentic,
and she's moderate but also highly left wing, and I think we'll see in the next few weeks or months whether the Labour Party membership is going to double down on this kind of toilet bowl draining, yeah, kind of ever diminishing, focusing on left wing politics, a lot of which I'm sympathetic with, but don't translate to votes, or whether they're actually going to challenge themselves and think about having a leader who can win an election. And for me, Jess Phillips would be amazing at doing that. And I know people are talking about Keir Starmer, which might work as well, but personally, he wouldn't convince me to vote for Labour, but Jess Phillips would in a heartbeat, I think.
Personally, I pay a lot of money to see Jess Phillips go up against Boris Johnson at PMQs. I think that would be quite explosive.
It would be completely
contrasting views and completely different messaging for the public.
I think there are buttons that you can push with Boris Johnson which get him to respond in a way which doesn't come across well, and I can imagine her doing that fairly effectively.
But I don't honestly think she has that wide, broad appeal within her own party. I think there are pockets which think she's wonderful, and I think there's a lot of people, if I'm honest, in other parties who think she's wonderful. But actually, from what I've seen and heard, and the way that she's attacked by her own members on social media and in Labour blogs is quite vicious, and I therefore that gives me doubt as to whether she'd be able to command that kind of support, or if she'd even want to do the job.
There is a problem, though, about the level of abuse that any kind of female candidate in that kind of position is going to have to face. It will be disproportionately high compared to a male, a man going for that kind of position.
Absolutely.
And I just think that that's something that needs to be fundamentally addressed, and we just haven't grappled it at all.
Mm. Again, a big topic for another podcast in future, but let's turn back to Wales again. We've slightly diverged off. I think, so obviously, minds will now be focused on the Assembly elections. What is this result going to mean for Mark Drakeford's government during the next 18 months? What's the dynamic going to be between him? And do we think this is good news for Mark Drakeford? Does this boost his chances of a good result for him in the next Assembly elections?
I think Mark Drakeford's got a massive challenge facing him the next 18 months. He's one of the least recognised politicians in Wales publicly. We recently did a schools project. We went to different schools across Wales. No one could name the First Minister at all. And I think that's quite alarming. The thing that Adam Price has had during this campaign is he's shored up any losses. They retained their four seats. He's effectively had a very good campaign in that he's been able to promote himself on the UK platform. His recognition rates in Wales will go up a lot higher. I think Plaid are entering next Assembly elections in a much better chance. The other issue I think we've got in the Assembly elections is where the Welsh Conservatives go. I don't know quite how to put this, but I think there's tensions within the party about how Welsh and how in favour of devolution, further devolution they make themselves. And I think that that's becoming quite apparent at the moment with the way that they reacted to things like Vote to 16 and the Senate Elections Bill. I think a couple of the Conservative MPs that got elected last night may be a little bit less favourable for devolution than we have had in the past. And I think that's really going to come across the campaign that is likely to have some discussion of abolishing the Assembly.
Is that fair, Mia? Is the new Conservative government in Westminster going to try and work with Mark Drakeford to make devolution work?
I can't answer that question, but in responding to Jess's point about comments about sort of devo sceptic people within the Conservative Party, Welsh Conservative Party, and that's a really fair point. I think the other point I'd add on that is that Welsh Conservative voters do not turn out in the numbers they do in generals in Assembly elections. So actually, I think it's really important to bear in mind that particularly in these northern seats that the Conservatives have won in this general election, they're not massive majorities, and actually I would say those voters are less likely to turn out in an Assembly election. So I think that Labour shouldn't be complacent in those seats, but I think the Conservatives have got to be a bit honest with themselves and say, no, this was a general, it is a different beast to an Assembly election for us, if I'm completely honest. And I think actually Jess's point goes back to this issue with membership. The membership of the Welsh Conservative Party, colloquially from my half, it is that it's a bit devo-sceptic, it's quite sceptic about the Assembly. Now, part of the scepticism about the Assembly is because, of course, it's been run by Labour since the beginning, and I think that doesn't help that argument. But I think that there is a build of that within the party, but it's at that very grassroots level, and at the moment is not shared by those at the top of the party who are currently the elected representatives in the Senate.
Oliver, what do you think this is going to mean, from Mark Draper, from your point of view?
So my, I'll be honest, my concern, because generally I think the Labour Party in Wales has been a force for good. Speaking professionally now, not personally, they have produced world-leading legislation on homelessness, and really put their money in action where their mouth is around that. And I think that would be a real challenge for people in that position. My concern in terms of Mark Drakeford of the Labour Party is that voting is pattern forming, and once someone takes the decision to break the kind of that vice of the traditional way of voting. I was saying before we started recording that, you know, looking at Newport East yesterday, there were Tory leads in a lot of boxes, for Liswery, Alway, places where traditionally Labour is massively ahead. And a lot of those voters didn't even, a lot of them did vote Brexit, but a lot of them went the full switch straight over to the Conservatives without that middle way that we thought they might. And so I would be, Mia's absolutely right, I think the Conservatives do turn out less in the Welsh Assembly elections, but if the ones that turn out are the Labour Party members who have finally broken, you know, South Wales, Newport East, you know, voters supporting Conservatives in kind of the deepest estates in South Wales, that's quite spectacular. And so I would be very worried if I was the Labour Party in the Assembly election. I think just really quickly on the plight, Cymru perspective, I think they've had a really good result. I'm not sure they've had a great campaign. And I think what they've done is they've definitely shored up their support. But I would be, I think if I was someone from Plaid Cymru, thinking how do I get out of those seats and into other areas, I think that's still an area where they're really struggling. And so I think, you know, again, in the Assembly election, maybe some of the smaller opposition parties should be thinking about working together better. It's, again, something Richard Wynne-Jones does say a lot, which I fully agree with, and Roger Scully, that in Wales, Labour has been hugely benefited by a divided opposition. There's never one vehicle for everyone to coalesce around. So I think smaller opposition parties, if they want to do well in the Assemblies, need to have some tough conversations with each other.
I think it's time to talk about Brexit. It's been mentioned a few times. It may have come up once or twice during the campaign. I think we probably agree that Get Brexit Done has been really effective as a slogan. The next stage is to get Brexit right. It's, you know, there's no prospect now of not leaving the EU. I wonder, some of the voters who were Leave voters who, you know, wonder why it's taken so long to do this and have voted accordingly. When we are at a future election where Brexit has happened and we are living through it, will people like Brexit once they're living through it, and is that going to affect?
I'll be completely honest, I don't think the Brexit referendum was a great campaign. I think it was, to be completely honest, I campaigned actively for Remain in that referendum. I don't think the Remain side did a very good job of selling the benefits, but I also think that the Leave side were very oversimplistic in what they sold. And I think this goes back to people think that we vote for something, well, it should just happen. It's a really long, complicated process. And actually, it's quite rude to say that to somebody who voted Leave. Well, actually, it's a really complicated process and you don't understand it. I mean, how could you say that to someone? But there is a real feeling of that. And of course, even though Brexit might be done, I don't think a lot of people realise all of the things that need to happen now, which are critically important for our economy to function. Even just function, not even function well. And I think, although Brexit might happen, I think there will be a bit of a sharp shock for a lot of people in what happens after that, and actually how long that wave of what happens afterwards and how that continues to affect us.
It depends what you draw a circle around and call it Brexit doesn't
true.
It? If it's passing the withdrawal legislation and that's done, then that's presumably the approach that will be taken. Well, was Brexit, and now this is something else.
There's also, I think, the I can't remember the term, but yes, the irony is that with a majority this big, Brexit is more likely to happen. It's done, it's happening.
It's going to happen.
But it's much more likely to be less of a sort of no deal, disruptive, chaotic Brexit. I mean, I could be completely wrong. I hope.
Well, I'm not sure. Because we've had the commitment from Boris Johnson that, you know, the trade negotiations will be concluded and we'll be either out with a trade arrangement or we'll be out with no trade arrangement by the end of next year. Which so the default and the one that feels still quite likely in that situation is a no-deal Brexit, because the time scale is so tight. And the only way to get a trade deal quickly is essentially to agree immediately to whatever the EU puts on the table.
I think the fact that he's got such a large majority means that he will have finally managed something that David Cameron and Theresa May couldn't do, which is neutralise the ERG, which has been a thorn in the side for Conservative Prime Ministers for years. So I think with that kind of political cover, and also the fact that the Conservative Party are going to basically agree to whatever Boris Johnson wants, certainly for the next 12 months, given that he's delivered this scale of majority, I think he will be able to pursue a softer Brexit as a result of that, which may be completely wrong, but that is my hope. Certainly this morning on a sleep-deprived night.
I think the next big question surely is around the future of the Union. It seems almost certain that Scotland will have a further referendum and vote for independence in the future. And I would hesitate to comment on Irish politics in too much detail, because I really don't feel I'm an expert in that. But it certainly feels like it's increased the probability of unity on Ireland. So that would leave Wales and England as the, you know, the legacy UK. We're talking about, we might come on to constitutional reform. Like, what needs to happen now to ensure Wales's voice is heard within the Union? And if you incline to protect the Union, make sure that happens.
I think essentially what is going to happen to the Union over the next 5 years is that it's going to fall apart. Realistically, Boris Johnson's Brexit deal puts a regulatory border in the Irish Sea. It creates complete separation between the island of Ireland and the rest of the UK, and I think that's going to have long-lasting consequences. And it is likely that we in Wales will be left as just England and Wales. And I think you've got two options. You know, what does Wales become kind of subsumed? You know, does it have a voice, or do we actually see a rise in support for independence?
I mean, I think. Well, certainly Plaid Cymru would argue that we are already seeing that rise in support, and it feels likely that will increase in light of the, you know, this yesterday's result. We also mentioned earlier that there's an increasing movement in Wales against the Assembly entirely. The Abolish the Assembly Party came, was it fifth or sixth in the last Assembly elections, and at one point Roger Scully's political barometer was polling that they would get seats in the next Assembly at one point. I mean, is that going to be Wales's version of a populist election next time? Are we going to have independence versus abolishing devolution entirely being, you know, part of the battleground of the next Assembly election?
I think the Welsh Conservatives have matured far enough that I don't think they would ever go back to abolishing the Assembly. That would absolutely astound me if that was to happen. At the end of the day, as David Davis has said, there was a referendum and I disagreed with the result, but I have lived with it and I think the Assembly should be there. And I think we've gone so far down the road to abolish it, but I think it would be really interesting to see as it develops the Welsh Conservative position on further devolution of powers, increasing numbers of AMs, those sorts of things. That'll be really interesting. And if, as a reaction from these sorts of things, and to show real divergence, I mean, obviously they're a very different party to Plaid Cymru, but to really show a true sort of choice across the spectrum there, whether they actually make it a policy and a campaign, we oppose further devolution, you know, we oppose the extension of the Assembly. It'll be interesting to see if that's where the Welsh Conservatives go as we approach 2022.
One. And the appetite for further major constitutional change in the public is going to be a factor again?
I don't think there is much. I mean, I think those of us who are in it, I mean, I worked for an assembly member who was a chairman of a committee. He also sat on another really major committee, and he was a constituency AM, and he was the health spokesperson for the party. I genuinely don't know how we did it. It was far too much work for one individual, and that's not sustainable. But at the same time, the public don't like politicians. They don't want more of them. And I do understand both sides of that coin.
Well, I think we'll draw proceedings to a close. But thank you all for coming in and joining us on the Welsh Agenda podcast. And I hope to have some of you back with us again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The IWA is a think tank and charity, independent of government and independent of political parties. By bringing together experts from all backgrounds, we conceive ambitious and informed ideas which secure political commitments to improve our democracy, public services, and our economy. We provide platforms for debate, like this podcast, and give opportunities for people to make their voices heard, and we undertake agenda-setting research. Our aim is to make Wales better. One of the ways we retain our independence is through the support of our members. So if you want to join the IWA, visit iwa.wales for more information. In the new year, we're going to be doing more podcasts like this, so we want to hear from you. What should we be talking about, and who should we be talking to? Send us a message via Twitter @IWA_Wales. Thanks for listening. We'll see you in 2020.